This is Christy, and we have merchandise. Go to howtolovelitpodcast.com and check out amazing t-shirts, mugs, stickers. If you love great quotes, we have some of our favorites. If you love silliness, check out our mascot, Brain Man. Go to howtolovelitpodcast.com, clip on the shop button, and find something for that person who needs to be reminded that we are fashion creatures but half made up. Mary Shelley said that.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Christy Schreiber, and we're here to discuss books that have changed the world and have changed us.
And I'm Gary Schreiber, and this is the How to Love Lit podcast. This is our second of three episodes analyzing Jon Krakauer's breakout journalistic nonfiction narrative of the life of Chris McCandless. Christy, it's a little hard to describe Krakauer's style. He's definitely writing nonfiction, and you know there is a sense that it's a biography. But as you pointed out last episode, it's not just biography. Krakauer is creating a piece of rhetoric. I mean, he's making an argument about Chris McCandless, but also about the human spirit in general. I mean, you know what it can do, what it longs to do, what it must do, and. Perhaps. And, you know, last episode we introduced the news item that sparked the entire story world titled Dying in the Wild, a hiker recorded the terror. We introduced the idea that there are times when ideas and stories or perhaps events are so powerful that they take on something greater than their origins. And, you know, this certainly has been the case with the story of Chris McCandless. The story world began with a news article, but the greatest contributor, or really the person responsible for uncovering what happened to Chris McCandless, was Jon Krakauer. And, you know, something that took literally decades to unfold, and, you know, perhaps it's still unfolding. And last week we discussed chapters 1 through 5, where Krakauer, as best as humanly possible, retraced McCandless's steps from the time he drove out of Atlanta in his little Datsun until the time he turned his sights and, you know, seriously directed himself to his ultimate adventure, which was Alaska. In order to get to the heart of the story, Krakauer retraced McCandless's steps himself, traveling across the American West, uncovering as best he could the path that Chris took. And he interviewed as many people as he found to have known McCandless during his years hitchhiking and walking and canoeing across the West. And he studied Chris's journal, and he pieced together his pretty extensive correspondence. And he got to know the McCandless family and listened for hours as those that loved him revealed not only McCandless's activities, but his motivations and his personality. And, you know, the McCandless family dynamic on top of that. And all of this is in seemingly in pursuit of an answer to question that has surrounded his death, or really perhaps the accusation that surrounded his death. You know, and that was Chris McCandless a crazy person, or worse, an unprepared, arrogant narcissist who got what he had coming? You know, today we rejoin Krakauer and continue to listen to him make his case that the answer to that question is a resounding no.
You're right. Krakauer argues that McCandless is not just a sane person, he's not just a good person, but he's very much like each of us, or at least he's an extreme version of us, a version of us that perhaps maybe even we wish we could be if we had the nerve that he has, and then maybe we don't. You know, I like how you said, listen to him make his case, because that's a good way to understand the way that Krakauer has organized his book. If you read the book expecting a chronological narrative, you may get frustrated and you'll likely miss the point. He's making a case. He's constructing reasoning we can follow, not necessarily a straight linear retelling of a story in order that we can understand events as they occurred chronologically. He uses many strategies that we all use when we try to write persuasively. He compares and he contrasts. He uses his personal story. He gives examples from history. He develops process analysis. He categorizes. He uses, in many ways, an augmented version of Aristotle's classical outline of rhetoric by starting with an introduction, giving us background, developing claims in the body of the work. He includes a very sophisticated refutation, and he projects at the end. He weaves all three classical appeals, ethos, pathos, logos, into each claim that he makes, developing credible points that are both logical and emotionally provocative. As we continue reading and discussing the book, it's important, especially if you're a student of rhetoric, to pay attention to how Krakauer organized this mountain of information from hundreds of different sources to create one coherent and unified argument.
Christy, the English teacher, I want to point out, you threw out a bunch of rhetorical terms. Do you think that Krakauer was aware of all those Aristotelian terms, or did he just start writing?
You know, isn't that always the question that people ask when it comes to art? Is the artist aware of his technique, or is it just natural, and then academic people come along after the fact and throw on a bunch of fancy terms to describe something they can't understand?
I think the answer to that question is yes. It's all the above.
Well, you know, if I ever get a chance to chat with Krakauer, I'd love to ask him. But I have heard him talk on YouTube about his process. And so I think I can answer the question. You know, Krakauer, when he's asked, and he's asked a lot about his writing, I find it interesting that he says that I'm just really not that great of a writer. And what does he mean by that? He says that, and I'm going to, you know, kind of paraphrase his words. He says when he writes his first drafts, he finds them unreadable. So he doesn't hinge his style on this great ability that he thinks he has to create a clever turn of phrase at the tip of his tongue that would change your mind. What he does well is argument building. He gathers information, he organizes information, he builds claims, and then he lays his ideas out on paper. And after those ideas go on paper, he first reads them and he says, well, maybe it's not pretty, but he does have a sharp ear. And so he revises and he revises and he revises until those ideas sound good to him and he likes what he's written. I heard him say in an interview that sometimes he has to rewrite a single sentence 100 times, if you can believe that. Of course, that's exactly what F. Scott Fitzgerald said about his own writing technique, by the way.
Well, I think he's in pretty fine company then if he's doing that, you know. So if he's revising, I guess then he's aware of technique.
I would say he probably is.
Yes.
But of course, since so many schools teach his book, I'm sure he's been asked about how to organize information many times. And in the interview I was just referencing, he said that he wrote his article first, and then when he realized he wanted to turn his article into a book, he took that article and he used that as an outline, and he just expanded the article out, developing the different points that he made in the book, or in the article, more fully in the book. So let's break that down. What appears to be the way that he's outlined his the argument in the book. So first, it starts with chapter one. Of course, that's going to be his introduction. And he chooses to introduce us to his main character through this person of Jim Gallion. And it's through Gallion's eyes that we watch Chris walk into the wild. Chapter two gives us a little background material on the area. We learn about the Stampede Trail in Denali National Park, and we meet the group of hunters who discover McCandless' body. We know from the beginning that Chris McCandless walks into the wild, but will not walk out of it. In chapter 3 through 5, we began to retrace McCandless' steps, starting with Krakauer's visit to Carthage, South Dakota, the last place McCandless really settled down before heading to Alaska. But after that, Krakauer will flash back to McCandless's college days in Atlanta and move us through his adventures somewhat chronologically. We meet people who were important to McCandless and with whom McCandless maintained a relationship while on the road, something that he did not do with his family, by the way. We meet Wayne Westerberg and Jan Burris and Charlie. We explore the Mojave Desert, the Colorado River, Bullhead City, and the Slabs. All of this in service of Krakauer's first point. Chris McCandless had a pattern and a plan, an informed central vision. He was not a vagrant loafing aimlessly on the earth, although it could have looked like that from time to time. Chris would push his body physically to the extreme. He would seek extreme environments, and he would find his breaking point, and then he would just kind of pull back. Krakauer demonstrates at least three times where he can document McCandless doing just that. This was not the action, or these were not really the actions of a madman, but this is a man with a mission, a stated mission. The mission to prepare his body, his spirit, and his mind for what he considers to be the ultimate frontier, Alaska. And Alaska is not just Alaska for Alaska's sake. McCandless has something that he's looking for. He's in search of truth. What is such a thing, or if such a thing even exists? And he's looking to the natural world for the answer.
Before we move forward, I want to open a parenthesis here. We mentioned last week that Krakauer, through writing the book, developed a relationship and a close friendship with the McCandless family, Chris's parents, as well as his siblings, specifically Corinne, but the other siblings as well. And as I think about what happened to Chris, I have to say that as a parent, I cannot imagine a greater gift a person could give this family than the gift Krakauer gave to the McCandlesses. And it's not fame and it's not fortune or anything that came from the book's success. I mean, you know, Krakauer uncovered answers. This family would have never known what happened to their son. In Chapter 4, Krakauer discloses the fact that Walt McCandless used his contacts within the United States Defense Intelligence Agency to find and hire one of the best private investigators in the country, a man by the name of Peter Kalicka. Peter Kalicka had worked successfully for the DIA and the CIA, and he was a highly qualified, trained specialist, but Kalicka was unable to locate Chris. And Chris, by using the alias Alex, staying on the road and not using credit cards or trackable information, he was completely off the radar and off the grid. And he did not want to be found and was not going to allow himself to be found. Kalicka found what was possible to discover. Chris had given away all of his money to a charity. And, you know, and as a parent, I cannot imagine how difficult it would be to live with no knowledge of what happened to their child. But just to know my child was found in a bus in Alaska. But Krakauer solved the riddle. He found pictures and letters, and with the help of Chris's journal, provided answers. And maybe they are totally accurate. Maybe they are flawed. We can't know everything, but they are answers. And, you know, really, there just could not be a greater gift to a family.
No, I agree. And as the story has grown and developed over the years, specifically with Corinne's book that addresses the domestic violence that pervaded the McCandless home when they were growing up, these perspectives have shifted as we've become more aware of the facts of the case. People have been angry with Chris for many years for leaving his family in the dark. People have accused him of destroying his mother's life for selfish reasons. There's so many emotions that Chris's story has aroused in so many people since his death. As they relate to him and to the story, you know, people really like him or they really hate Chris. And these are all people, including me, that we've never met him. However, if you read the transcripts of the people who actually interacted with Chris while he was alive, there is one thread that has been consistent, and that's from those who knew Chris as a child to the last man known to have spoken with him before he went down that stampede trail. And it is the idea that to know Chris was really to like him. And the more you knew him, the more likely you were to like him. And if you had the pleasure of engaging him closely, chances are you would grow to love him. Many people have said he was odd. A lot of people have said he was intense, maybe idealistic. But the consensus is that he is actually just extremely likable. One of the last people Krakauer engaged that had any kind of extensive relationship with Chris was an 80-year-old leather worker that Krakauer names Ronald Franz in his book. Franz requested a pseudonym. He didn't want his identity to get out. But Franz was not someone Krakauer tracked down originally through any material that he found on the bus or from the family. Quite the opposite. Franz had reached out to Outside Magazine when he heard about Chris's death from two hitchhikers who had read the Krakauer piece. You know, the magazine forwarded Franz's correspondence to Krakauer, and then Krakauer went to meet him. And he learned that Franz had taught Chris how to work with leather, and that Chris had created a pictorial record of all of his adventures in a belt that he had made from leather. He also learned that Chris had confided in Franz that he intended to go to Alaska in the spring, and that this trip would be his, quote, let me quote Franz here, his ultimate adventure.
You know, chapter 6, the one you're referring to about Ron Franz, has a really long letter included that Chris penned to Franz. It's 2.5 pages typed, and it's not the kind of thing I would have expected Krakauer to include in a book. It's a letter written by a young man giving advice to an old man, which, you know, seems a bit of a reversal. And at first pass, it even seems arrogant and the kind of thing that might not make Chris look like a good person. And yet by reading it, we hear Chris's voice maybe clearer than anywhere else. Chris's voice is not the voice of a crazy person or, you know, an egomaniac. It's also not the voice of a person who's fleeing or trying to hide. It's really the voice of youth, the voice of a young man who is running towards something and searching. And he's searching for something that we all search for, which is meaning and truth. And it is Chris's contention that he will find truth through engagement with the natural world. It's not a crazy proposition. It's actually a very natural part of being young. And, you know, that's why we have so many books and movies about young people going on adventures. I mean, it's archetypal almost. And in a sense, what he's doing is an act of humility. It's a confession that there are things that I just don't know, but I don't want to leave this earth without knowing them or at least pursuing them. To me, it's the opposite of complacency, which is a direct that some people, young people, will go.
Well, and now since we understand how deceptive a home life he had and how his parents were intent on painting a picture for the world of a false reality that they really weren't living, it makes sense that he would be suspicious of finding truth in people and how they presented themselves. You know, let's read a little excerpt from the letter so we can hear his voice. You know, in this part of the letter, we won't read the whole letter, but in this part, he has admonished Franz because Franz had driven past the Grand Canyon and had not stopped to look at it.
You had a wonderful chance on your drive back to see one of the greatest sights on earth, the Grand Canyon, something every American should see at least once in his life. But for some reason incomprehensible to me, you wanted nothing but to bolt for home as quickly as possible, right back to the same situation which you see day after day after day. I fear you will follow this same inclination in the future and thus fail to discover all the wonderful things that God has placed around us to discover. Don't settle down and sit in one place. Move around. Be nomadic. Make each day a new horizon. You're still going to live a long time, Ron, and it would be a shame if you did not take the opportunity to revolutionize your life and move into an entirely new reality of experience. You are wrong if you think joy emanates only or principally from human relationships. God has placed it all around us. It is in everything, in anything we might experience. We just have to have the courage to turn against our habitual lifestyle and engage in unconventional living.
You know, I really like that passage for a couple of reasons. First of all, we can see that Chris really does care about Franz, and that's sweet. But more interestingly, you know, we see more of McCandless's vision and his understanding of the world. Of course, it's a young man's vision. You know, Chris's life as it was had been given to him through his family dynamic, through his socioeconomic situation, through his academic and social expectations, and it wasn't what he wanted. And so his answer to all that was just to move. You know, Chris, in a sense, I guess, is hiding from his parents, but he's not hiding for the sake of fleeing. He's taking charge and redefining himself. He's pursuing a life by boiling down life to its essential elements, a place perhaps where he can understand it, understand truth, and have a shot at finding joy. what he's doing sounds like the plaque that today sits on the location of Thoreau's hut at Walden in Massachusetts. Let's read that quote from Walden.
I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear, nor did I wish to practice resignation unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms.
You know, some might say this is a very nuanced description of the same thing that Chris just said. Venturing out for a time in order to live more fully. It's a much more noble calling than a simple lunatic's desire to live off wild berries and sleep under stars because you don't want to take responsibility for your own existence. It's actually the opposite.
Well, I think it also shows that McCandless had been reading Thoreau's Walden maybe a little bit.
Well, he had, and we'll see when we get to chapter 16, and we'll talk about this next episode, that Thoreau was one of the authors he took with him into the wild, and it was his book that was on the bus with him.
Well, by the time we get to page 97, which is still a couple of chapters away from this letter, we see Krakauer's primary claim is really fleshed out more fully. You know, let me summarize Krakauer here, but essentially on page 97, Krakauer asserts that McCandless is not crazy, not self-involved, but in fact is following his dream, and this is what makes him great. And he's moved by courage and reckless innocence and, you know, the urgency of his desire.
So, you know, I know that you're quoting Krakauer there, moved by courage, reckless innocence, and the urgency of his desire. Do you think these are qualities of greatness?
You know, well, I'm not sure that's all that it takes, you know, but those elements are certainly on the list of requirements, and they are markers of youth, most definitely. But yes, people who follow a dream, they have to have courage. They have to have some reckless innocence or they wouldn't do it. And they have to feel a sense of urgency, really, to push towards a dream.
Well, you know, there's nobility in that idea. And it's on Krakauer to prove that these ideals, that those three that you just listed, apply to McCandless. Because you could say those are the things that make greatness, but he doesn't have those things. But Krakauer is going to try to convince us that Chris does have these attributes, and that's part of what makes him great.
You know what? I think I can tell that this argument really is appealing to you, Christy.
Well, it does. And I understand this kind of thinking. I understand the idea of having the courage to remake your story if you don't like it. I admire that. I also understand the value of adventure. I think it's important. You got to get out. You know, don't get me wrong. You know, I'm not as big of an outdoorsman as Krakauer. I mean, when you read what Krakauer did when he was young, it's crazy. It's crazier than what Chris did, to be honest. I mean, I'm not really going to say that I enjoy sleeping in tents, but, you know, I've gotten out enough to know Chris is unequivocally right in what he's telling Franz here. Every single one of us would benefit from getting out, discovering, let me quote Chris, all the wonderful things God has placed all around us. I mean, there's magic there. There's freedom. There's understanding of ourselves, of the world. I could go on. You know, I tell all my students every year, they should leave the country at least once. And if they go to college, they should definitely be a foreign exchange student. You know, that's because that's how I sought adventure. And I did it for many of these same reasons. You know, Chris proved you don't even need a lot of money to make that happen, although I wouldn't recommend hitchhiking, which was
no, not a good
point.
Thing.
You know, Chris's point to Franz and Krakauer's point in including the letter in the book is that we need courage and maybe even a little reckless innocence. Getting out scary, and for some of us it's horrifying, but it's important, and it's where you find joy. Chris, we will learn, was full of rage at one point in his life, but he found joy. And this joy enriched not just his life, but he was able to enrich the lives of people that he encountered along the way.
And that is Krakauer's contention, you know, and I buy it. But I like that Krakauer does not shy away from the fact that Alaskans don't buy it. I was surprised to find out, and I heard this again in an interview with Krakauer that he gave years ago after the book came out, that Alaskans just don't like Chris McCandless to this day. The bus where he died became a point of pilgrimage, and the people in the area are endlessly rescuing naive thrill seekers who are trying to recreate McCandless's experience, and this gets on their nerves.
Understandable.
Yes. Alaskans have sent a lot of negative mail to Krakauer over many years, and the complaints they register make perfect sense, and many of them see McCandless as one of the many, and I quote, idealistic, energetic young guys who overestimated themselves, underestimated the country, and ended up in trouble. McCandless was hardly unique. There's quite a few of these guys hanging around the state, so much alike that they're almost a collected cliche. The only difference is that McCandless ended up dead. The particular writer goes on to say, McCandless's postcards, notes, and journals read like the work of an above-average, somewhat histrionic high school kid.
Well, in fairness, do you think both descriptions of McCandless can be true? I mean, obviously, he was an idealistic, energetic young man that overestimated himself and underestimated the country and ended up in trouble. But does that take away from all these other things that we can say about him with how Krakauer represents him?
Of course not. I mean, I definitely think both descriptions can be true. It depends on which side of him you're looking at. And I understand why Alaskans, especially Native Alaskans who've grown up with the highest respect for the land, would find a lot of what he did to be insulting. I mean, he came to their land, and in their view, he didn't respect it. And so he got what one gets when one doesn't respect natural law. But the question I would like to posit at this time, and you know, who hasn't done this in one way or another? McCandless made mistakes for sure, but so has everyone who has ventured out. And those who didn't venture out, are they really sure they didn't lose out and make a mistake by staying safe?
What Krakauer does in Chapter 8 is offers a refutation to the most common and most logical criticisms that rational people have raised in regard to Chris McCandless.
Well, I think we should revisit those. Tell us, please, about what is a refutation.
Well, in Aristotle's model, a writer should offer all of his arguments for why something is true, but then he should include a refutation. In other words, if someone disagrees with me, what would be their most common or most logical objections? So let me give you this example. Let's say I want to order pizza and you want to order burgers for supper. And I would say, we should get pizza because the pizza parlor is close, the pizza parlor is cheap, and at this time of night, it's the only place that delivers. So those are my arguments. But then I would offer a refutation, and I would say this. Now, I know what you're thinking. We just had pizza 2 days ago, and that's true. So I have your position. I'm not going to refute it, and this might be my refutation. But at this time of night, for the amount of money I have in my pocket, and since I'm paying for something, I think we should still get the pizza.
Well, I think it's amazing that Aristotle is debating pizza at this point.
Well,
you think that ever happened?
No. Well, I don't know. He was close to Italy, I guess. In my example, the refutation is where I'm saying I think you're thinking, and I give you the reasons why I understand why you would be opposed to my ideas. In Krakauer's case, which is much more serious, he's saying, I know what you're thinking. I know why you would think that Chris is crazy. And then in Chapter 8, he will give examples of people Alaskans may think are crazy. And they may think he's just like McCandless, or these other people are just like McCandless. Several of them are general references, but he does give real true stories of specific people. Gene Rossellini, John Waterman, Carl McDunn. And Krakauer will assert, I understand what you find crazy about these guys, but McCandless isn't like those guys, although he may look like he is. Then he goes on in Chapter 9 to compare McCandless with other people, specifically some Irish monks, a man by the name of Everett Roos, who also died in the wild. And Krakauer is going to say, Chris is more like these guys, and these guys are demonstrably brave, they're recklessly innocent, and they're driven. He's going to say, these are two separate groups of people. They're not the same thing.
Well, I agree. These two groups of people are not the same. And so now, in light of these examples, we're going to take a look at Chris's life again. Is he like one of the men in Chapter 8 who were kind of crazy? Or is he more like the brave and daring monks of Chapter 9?
And to do that, after Krakauer introduces these other characters, he's going to jump back into Chris's life before Alaska. You know, Chapter 11 starts with a quote that's taken from Dr. Zhivago, and Dr. Zhivago was one of the books found with Chris McCallum's remains. The quote that starts the chapter is a quote that was highlighted, and right beside the highlighted portion in Chris's handwriting was the phrase, "need for a purpose," which is interesting. Let's read the quote that Chris highlighted.
"Everything had changed suddenly, the tone, the moral climate. You didn't know what to think, whom to listen to, as if all your life had been led by the hand like a small child, and suddenly you were on your own. You had to learn to walk by yourself. There was no one around, neither family nor people whose judgment you respected. At such a time, you felt that need of committing yourself to something absolute, life or truth or beauty, of being ruled by it in place of the man-made rules that had been discarded. You needed to surrender to some such ultimate purpose more fully, more unreservedly than you had ever done in the old familiar peaceful days. Aye, the old life that was not abolished and gone for good." So, Chrissy, let's talk about why Krakauer uses this quote to introduce Chapter 11, the chapter about Chris's childhood.
Well, you're the psychology teacher. I mean, what are your thoughts? Of course, we mentioned it before, but when Krakauer researched the book, Corinne entrusted letters Chris had written to her over the years. And these letters were rough, and many of them enumerated instances and described examples of domestic violence that Chris and Corinne experienced as children. Corinne did not want Krakauer to reference any of this in his book because these kinds of revelations would be embarrassing, especially for her parents. And Chris hadn't been dead very long at that time, and she just didn't want that kind of tension. It's understandable in her own family dynamic. She wanted to preserve, maybe even repair, her relationship with her parents. So, but knowing that bit of information now, sometimes that colors the way we read Chapter 11. We know when Krakauer says that Walt McCandless is a dark and mercurial man with a famously volatile temper, we know what that means, that maybe he's even downplaying the situation. These were very carefully selected words for a purpose.
Well, true. And these words certainly don't condemn Walt McCandless as a child abuser. I mean, it's extremely respectful of Krakauer to allow Corinne to tell her story her way, in her words and in her time, but even leaving out the part of the abuse. I mean, there's enough in this chapter to allow most people to understand that Chris was justified in being angry with not just his father, but also with his mother. His father was a bigamist by any definition of the word. He maintained one family in wealth, that would be Chris and Corinne and her mother, and the other family in abject poverty. And, you know, Walt demanded from his son excellence in everything, and Chris tried to give it to him. And Chris was a successful student, a successful athlete, a successful musician. He was an entrepreneur. He pushed himself in every way, including morally. I mean, he fed beggars. He talked to prostitutes. He offered suggestions to help them get out of a lifestyle they felt trapped in. And one time, he even brought a homeless person home to live in their Airstream in the garage, all without telling his parents. You know, when Chris found out that his father had a secret family, that he had siblings from the other family that were younger than he was, and that his mother was a part of this, he viewed his entire life, and let's quote Chris here, his entire childhood seemed like a fiction. You know, these kinds of revelations are more than just injuries that make children rage. They are disorienting to the child for their whole meaning of their existence in this life. And, you know, Chris understandably did not know who he was.
I know it's not the same thing, but in some ways it kind of reminds me of some of the things Frederick Douglass says when he talks about, you know, how disorienting it was for him to not know who his father was.
Well, you know, these two men do have something in common. They both set out to redefine themselves by defining freedom and truth. And, you know, the difference is Douglass always knew that he didn't know who his father was. But in McCandless's case, he thought he knew who his parents were. And then all of that was deconstructed right in front of his eyes. And what is even worse, when kids find out things about their parents that are disturbing, for example, I mean, if you find out your parent has a mental illness or has done something atrocious, the natural thought is, and perhaps the very first thought of the child is, am I like that? Is that in me too? Because I'm 50% of that parent.
So you're saying Krakauer is creating a picture of Chris McCandless, who in Alaska is trying to, quote, find himself?
No, not exactly. I don't think that's it at all, although there's definitely evidence that he was pushing himself to see where his limits were. I think the most accurate way to describe what I see Chris McCandless doing is trying to reinvent himself. And let's quote Thoreau, a philosopher we know Chris was reading. I learned this, at least by my experiment, that if one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours.
Well, McCandless was young, and part of that is reflected in his choices for physical challenges, and physical risks sometimes end up in accidents. And this is where John Krakauer came to identify with Chris McCandless, and this is where we will start next episode. Because in chapters 14 and 15, Krakauer tells the story of his youth. He went to Alaska, and he did, some would say, a very similar thing. I would say he did a more dangerous thing. You know, he went to Alaska into the wild alone. He pushed his body to a crazy physical limit. He was vulnerable to millions of different accidents of nature. You know, and by his own admission, the only difference between Krakauer and McCandless is that Krakauer was lucky and he was able to walk out.
You know, if I think about my youth, I would have to admit I took my share of chances, and some of them could have been just as lethal as McCandless's. It's amazing any of us make it.
Well, I know. And you know, in my case, for less noble reasons,
yes.
For sure. You know, as we listen to Krakauer and as we listen to Chris's own voice and as we listen to the voices of Chris's critics, which this part contained a lot of those, many of whom come from the land where Chris's body was found, I come to the conclusion that there is a possibility that all these conflicting voices about Chris McCandless are all correct. They're all painting a picture of a young man who's human. And that reminds me of another great American adventurer and writer who I love and you love, Walt Whitman, and his famous passage out of Song of Myself 51, where he describes what being a human means. Let's end this episode not by quoting a writer that Chris quoted, but by quoting someone of a kindred spirit. And these are the words of Walt Whitman. The past and the present wilt, I have filled them, emptied them, and proceed to fill the next fold of my adventure. Listener up there, what have you to confide to me? Look in my face while I snuff the sidle of evening. Talk honestly. No one ever hears you, and I stay only a minute longer. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then. I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. It's an amazing truth. Chris McCandless was large. He contained multitudes. John Krakauer is large, and he contains multitudes. But so is every one of us. And that is a wonderfully positive thing.
Well, and on that note, I wish I had a nickel for every time you've looked at me and said, do I contradict myself? Very well, then. I contradict myself. All right, well, that's it for this episode. And don't forget, you can always find us at howtolovelitpodcast.com. On our website, we have listening guides for most of our issues, as well as other teaching resources. Also, whether you're a teacher, a student, or a fellow lover of literature, please subscribe to our podcast via YouTube or Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a rating, and if you like what you hear, possibly review. It's when you share about the podcast to your friends that we grow. And thank you for supporting us in our mission to make reading great literature accessible and enjoyable to as many people as possible.
Peace out.